Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Hady Adams. Thank you for joining me. This week, we're taking an in-depth look at the worsening conflict and growing humanitarian disaster in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. There is concern in Africa and other parts of the world that the East African nation could slide into full-scale civil war. Is there a pathway to peace in Ethiopia? Karin Kaneza-Nantulia from Human Rights Watch joins us to talk about lessons learned from other conflicts. We'll also bring you a VOA-exclusive documentary, Terror in Tigray. VOA's correspondent Heather Murdoch travelled to the largely cut-off conflict zone as well as refugee camps in neighbouring Sudan and brings us the stories of those displaced by the conflict. We'll have in-depth reporting, analysis and your opinion. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Ethiopia is one of Africa's most powerful and populous countries. It's also one of the continent's most well-armed nations. Ethiopia has endured military rule, famine, and civil war to become one of Africa's most promising nations. Just 2 years ago, analysts described the country as the continent's new economic powerhouse. But now Ethiopia is in the grips of a bitter conflict the United Nations says is marked by extreme brutality and possible crimes against humanity. How did the East African nation get here? Let's take a look at how and why the deadly conflict erupted.
The conflict in northern Ethiopia has displaced hundreds of thousands of people and rattled the region. Observers fear instability in the largest country in the Horn of Africa could spread beyond its borders. Here's how it got to this point. On November 4th, 2020, forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, attacked federal military bases in northern Ethiopia, according to the federal government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the attack crossed a red line and ordered the military to confront TPLF forces. This, he said, came after months of provocation and incitement. On November 6th, the Ethiopian military said it launched a campaign to retake TPLF strongholds in the north using precision airstrikes and ground forces to attack military targets, including Tigray's largest city, Makala. However, TPLF officials say there have been civilian casualties, including non-military targets, such as schools, places of worship, and infrastructure. To understand the roots of the conflict, you have to go back decades. Tigray, Ethiopia's northernmost region, played a vital role in the country's recent history. TPLF was an armed political movement that helped liberate Ethiopia from the brutal Derg regime, which finally fell from power in 1991. Then a Tigrayan ex-fighter, Meles Zenawi, led the new coalition government in 1991 that instituted a system known as ethnic federalism, which divided the country along ethnic lines into 10 regions with some autonomy. Meles and the coalition of political parties he founded, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, or EPRDF, held near total control in the country. Political dissent and free speech were severely restricted. But the country also enjoyed rapid economic growth during Meles' time in power, with impressive advances in the industrial sector. Still, ethnic resentment also grew. Tigrayans comprised only 6% of the population, but held outsized power in the military, business, and politics. Meles died in 2012. Widespread protests followed, leading to the resignation of his successor, Prime Minister Halimeriam Desalegn. Then, Abiy Ahmed, a young ethnic Oromo, rose to power in 2018. Abiy instituted a raft of reforms, including negotiating a peace deal with neighboring Eritrea and releasing political prisoners. In 2019, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But some of Abiy's reforms also deepened divisions. In 2019, he dissolved the ruling party, the EPRDF, and created the Prosperity Party. The TPLF refused to join the newly created party. By September 2020, the feud escalated. The Tigray region held elections, defying the central government, which had postponed national elections because of the coronavirus. The central government called the elections illegal. The rift grew in October when the central government suspended funding for and cut ties with the TPLF. Tigray's administration said this amounted to a declaration of war. And once the war began, it quickly escalated. On November 14th, the conflict spread in the region beyond its borders when the TPLF launched rocket attacks against neighboring Eritrea. TPLF leaders accused Eritrea of involvement in the conflict and said the country was a legitimate target because Asmara Airport and other locations in Eritrea were being used to support Ethiopian federal forces. On November 28th, days after surrounding the city of Makala, Ethiopian federal forces retook the city center, its airport, and military base. On the same day, Abiy declared an end to the conflict he termed a law enforcement operation. But later, TPLF's leader, Debretsion Gebremichael, vowed to fight on. The ensuing conflict has already involved neighboring states and shaken the Horn of Africa, which has long viewed Ethiopia as a pillar of regional stability. As is often the case in war, the most vulnerable people bear the brunt of the conflict. Cellular service and internet access in the region have largely been cut off. Communications blackout makes it nearly impossible to get accurate information about the conflict and its humanitarian cost. Tens of thousands of civilians fled Tigray, many on foot or on rickety boats across Ethiopia's Tekeze River, crowding into refugee camps across the Sudanese border. Although the fighting slowed in late December, its impact continues, with tens of thousands internally displaced and seeking refuge elsewhere. In Tigray, aid workers were denied access to refugee camps by the federal government. Relief agencies warned of continued dire conditions in what they called a full-scale humanitarian crisis in the region. As access to parts of the Tigray region is still restricted, the UN and other organizations say some people have died of starvation and many more are at risk, in addition to the spread of COVID-19. Refugees in the camps in Sudan say they won't return to their homes because they fear for their safety, and the long-term direction of the conflict remains uncertain.
Well, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he is concerned Ethiopia might implode unless all parties stop military action and engage in political dialogue. Secretary Blinken is visiting Africa this week. He's slated to visit Kenya, Nigeria and Senegal. And many worry that Ethiopia's year-long war in the Tigray region may be spiraling into a deeper conflict. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
Tensions in Ethiopia have risen following reports that Ethiopian authorities have rounded up hundreds of Tigrayans, including some who are United Nations and African Union staff members, days after the government declared a state of emergency. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the situation at the State Department.
I am very concerned about the potential for Ethiopia to implode, given what we're seeing, both in Tigray, but also as we have different forces and different ethnic groups that are increasingly at odds.
In the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, where officials have urged residents to take up arms to defend themselves, Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Dina Mufti had this to say about the detained UN and African Union staff members.
Ethiopia's state of emergency.
There is a force that is undertaking measures to ensure the rule of law prevails in Ethiopia. A resident UN staff should respect the law of the country. They are not in space. They are in Ethiopia. They have to respect Ethiopia's law one by one. If they don't respect the law of the land, they will be legally held accountable, whether they are a UN or African Union staff.
Blinken said the United States is working closely with the African Union envoy for the Horn of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, who is shuttling back and forth between Ethiopia and Kenya to help broker a ceasefire in the conflict that has left thousands dead and hundreds of thousands facing famine. Persuading the parties to hold talks is the only good path forward. Former Ambassador Makila James tells VOA.
Dialogue is the only long-term solution because this is a war that could drag on for a long time with no winners and lots of losers.
Ethiopia is likely to be high on the agenda as Blinken makes his first in-person trip to Africa as Secretary of State, visiting Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. Cindy Sane, VOA News.
Well, as Cindy Sane reported, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo is the African Union Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa. Obasanjo is urging the warring sides to find a political solution, but he doesn't think talks will succeed without a ceasefire.
All these leaders here in Addis Ababa and in the North agree individually that the difference between them are political and require political solution through dialogue. This, therefore, constitutes a window of opportunity.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the AU and the UN to hold an emergency session to press for a global arms embargo on Ethiopia and neighboring Eritrea and for the humanitarian blockade on Tigray to be lifted. It's also calling for targeted sanctions against members of all warring parties behind serious human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law, as well as an international investigation mechanism to preserve evidence of international crimes and pave the way for accountability. Now, earlier I spoke to Human Rights Watch's Africa Advocacy Director, Karine Kaneza Nantuya. She has worked on peace negotiations between the Ugandan government and the Lord's Resistance Army, as well as conflict resolution efforts in Burundi, Sierra Leone, South Africa, and Rwanda, to name a few. And we discussed lessons from negotiations in those conflicts and whether there is a pathway to peace for Ethiopia. Karine, I want to talk about this issue of contagion. What are the potential and now existing knock-on effects of this type of conflict that we see in Ethiopia? What's the impact on people, on neighboring countries, and on the African continent as a whole?
Thousands of refugees crossing into Sudan indicates how this can spread beyond Ethiopia's border. Some may even argue that the conflict have, as you correctly pointed out, could have weakened the Ethiopian state, which could have damaging regional consequences in itself, not to mention the knock-on effect in terms of refugees crossing into Sudan, crossing into Kenya. You also have Ethiopia, which is really anchored in a very strategic location with the Red Sea. That has impact not only on Ethiopia, but also on its on other regional governments and even Western partners.
Karine, you know, drawing on your experience and your expertise in conflict resolution, if we look at the lessons from other parts of Africa, can ethnic-based conflicts that have raged in other parts of the continent in the past, such as what we saw in Burundi's civil war, which also seemed endless and intractable at the time, or with the LRA in Uganda, can those conflicts and how they were resolved serve as a sort of roadmap for how to deal with Ethiopia today?
In a way, I would say yes. They are key ingredients to start anchoring a solid peace mediation. Parties should agree first and foremost on a ceasefire and cessation of hostilities. And for that, you may need to threaten and use sanctions, for instance. We need, and in order for these processes to hold, in order to have a de-escalation of the violence, You need to have a robust, dynamic mediation process with justice and accountability. And that's where, for instance, in the case of Burundi, that was not really the priority, with just having justice and accountability at the center of the process. And here again, processes like you mentioned Uganda, Burundi, but also South Sudan are good examples of how failing to anchor accountability mechanisms and implement them undermine long-term stability and political settlements. What do we need to have this a strong, sustainable mediation process? First of all, you need to have political will, which at this stage one is difficult to really see from the warring parties. Other ingredients, what we call precipitating factors, include a war fatigue. And as you know, we don't see it up until now. You need to have an equivocal engagement by partners and the international community at large, a sustained scrutiny and monitoring from the international community. What's worrying in Ethiopia is that institutions like the African Union, in the way they responded, they started to usher in quiet diplomacy, sending African mediators. You remember in 2020, President Ramaphosa sent three high-level peace brokers to meet with the Prime Minister Arbi, and the Prime Minister rebuffed those efforts. And in doing so, it was not just turning down a peace initiative. It's important that we understand that the refusal of the Ethiopian government to engage with envoys from the African Union challenged the foundational principles of the African Union itself, because you have very strong principles that are anchored within the African Union, including its Constitutive Act, to which Ethiopia acceded in 2002, which specifies that you need to have the right to intervene, which is called the duty of non-indifference, which was adopted in the wake of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. So those are some of the elements that we need to really look at in this specific case.
Now, Human Rights Watch has released a report calling for the African Union, the United Nations, and other international donors to support an international inquiry. Karine, how would you assess the African Union's response and interventions to the crisis so far? I mean, it is also significant that this is happening in a country where the AU's headquarters is based. But what do you make of the AU's response, and what, in your view, are its obligations, and what does it need to do beyond those obligations?
Let me just start by saying the Article 4G of the AU's Constitutive Act does specify non-intervention by any member state in the internal affairs of another. But that article is immediately followed by Article 4H, which gives the AU the right to intervene in a member state in respect of grave circumstances, namely war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, which is called the duty of non-indifference, which I mentioned earlier. It's important to understand that the AU does have those tools. How has the institution used them? As I mentioned, shuttle diplomacy, but they did not react until quite late in the conflict. Despite more than a year of crisis in Ethiopia's Tigray, amid rising tensions, a sweeping nationwide states of emergency, unlawful humanitarian blockade by Ethiopian authorities, the African Union did not speak up. Push in a forceful manner the Ethiopian government, Prime Minister Abiy, to lift, for instance, the humanitarian blockade, which now they are calling for. The AU Peace and Security Council waited until November 8th to raise the alarm and request the AU chairperson to provide periodic updates on the crisis, because one of the most important, action that the AU could have done was to raise Ethiopia and put it on the regular Peace and Security Council agenda, which they did not until November 8th, right? Let's also remember that the African Commission on Human and People's Rights is currently carrying out an investigation into the crimes, into serious crimes that have been committed between November and June 28th in Tigray. And I think it's important to also make the recommendation and call on the Peace and Security Council to continue to support the work of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, because there is a precedent in that, in the way the council has been collaborating with the commission, and in that way, let's recall the commission of inquiry that was conducted in Burundi in 2015. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights did produce a report which was never validated and endorsed by the African Union Peace and Security Council. And those are important elements that we need to see in order for justice and accountability to be part not only of the work of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, but also centered within the mediation process that is currently under the leadership of President Obasanjo.
And you know, there is the now and all the efforts to bring a political solution to this. But what about what happens afterwards? I mean, inside of this country, how does Ethiopia come back from this war, in your view? Because resolving the conflict itself is one thing, but then what follows next for the people of that country? How do you reconcile and unite a nation so divided? And are there lessons about what to do and what not to do that you have learned in places where you have lived and worked, like South Africa and Rwanda?
I think it's important to have a victim-centered process. I think the first lesson is that victims are the human face of this of any political process, and victims do need justice. They need reparation, and they need to reconcile with what has happened to them. And you have different models, right? South Africa went for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in which perpetrators could get amnesty on condition of full disclosure of their crimes, in the absence of which perpetrators were prosecuted. Rwanda, for instance, had a combination of international justice with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the Gacaca Courts, which are homegrown peace-building tools and institutions. And in both cases, there were shortcomings. And I think the most important lesson that we get from these, that we can draw from these different country examples, is that it's very important for any process to follow due diligence. It's very important that victims are part of these processes. It's important that accountability is implemented and pushed for, not only by human rights organizations and the victims, but also by stakeholders who more often than not will be sitting at the negotiation table. In Burundi, we have what we call the Arusha Peace Agreement, in which, and all most peace agreements will have a section, a protocol, really dealing with issues of justice and accountability. However, what happens more often than not is that you're not going to see a strong monitoring of these different protocols. You will not see implementation because there's no scrutiny and there's no pressure put on the warring parties or on the government, regardless of the political dispensation that came out of those negotiations. So those are some of the lessons that that I've been able to observe: justice and accountability being front and center in the mediation process and beyond.
And that was Karine Kaneza Nantulia. She's the Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, speaking to me earlier. Now, we also put a question on social media about this. We put it to you. We asked whether you think there is a pathway to peace in Ethiopia. And here's what some of you had to say. John Moses from Tanzania says peaceful dialogue and soft language is the only language which both sides should use to talk to each other. Ethiopia's prime minister should think of another way of solving this problem rather than send in more of his army to fight. John Chan Mawien from Sudan says if the parties in conflict accept negotiation to be mediated by external agents, then there will be peace. Martin Nyalusi from Tanzania says there will be a pathway to peace once the African Union will take over diplomacy rather than wait for bloodshed or wait for a solution from outside Africa. We know that no one can come and build your own house. Edward Sekikubo believes dialogue is the answer and says they should just talk and realize that the country belongs to both parties instead of letting the power of the gun decide for them. Muganzi Alex says African leaders should wake up and not let Ethiopia become like Libya. And then this comment from Makoa Bashir: constructive dialogue between both parties should be exclusively undertaken, looking at the past, the present, and also looking for a way forward, not forgetting the creation of a broad-based government that is inclusive. Thank you so much for your comments. We really appreciate your input. Earlier this year, VOA reporter Heather Murdoch traveled to Ethiopia's Tigray region and neighboring Sudan to document the experiences of those displaced by the conflict. In a few moments, we're going to show you those stories in VOA's documentary, Terror in Tigray. But first, Murdoch explains what it was like reporting from the conflict zone and what she and her team hope to accomplish through their reporting.
What I wanted to show with the documentary that I thought wasn't being accomplished in the news in general is the humanity of it, like the real people, because the people who are being impacted by this, they're just like you or me if we were in such an extraordinary situation. I also wanted people to know about the crisis on a larger scale. It's something that's widely reported, but so many people have come to me and said, I had no idea this was happening. Even somebody who follows Ethiopia closely, who's spent time there, finds Ethiopian politics and conflict very confusing and hard to understand. So I was hoping to not explain everything, but at least present the basics, that it's not impossible to care about it, even if it's difficult to understand at all. When I got to Tigray, it was a time about 10 days before the Tigrayan forces took over the Mekelle, or the capital city of the region. So one thing we could sense immediately was the tension between the government forces and the population. And the other thing that I noticed right away from the first day of interviews is that people in Tigray speak kind of with one voice. Like, they have opinions about who should be in charge, and they're not shy to say so, what they think, even though it is opposing, or was at the time opposing, the forces that were controlling their region. And then the third thing that surprised me was how in the center of this huge crisis, that everywhere we looked, there were people just trying to live normally and almost trying to pretend that nothing was happening. So people would be going about their normal lives, and then you'd go to the hospital and you'd see like the level of destruction that was happening in the region, but people still have to survive and go about their day and try to get on with it. As a journalist, I was completely surprised almost by everything in Ethiopia. The government of the past, I was there in 2010 with Meles Zenawi leading the country. That government was well known for being very hard on journalists, and many people would get detained and deported, including myself. And when we got to Ethiopia, I knew there was a different government, but I also knew that we would be reporting stories that particular government has in the past not liked. We just decided that we didn't have any option, that we would have to just go in, report the stories as we see them, and not hold them till we leave the country. I expected to be not harmed or even put in jail, but I expected to be asked to leave the country shortly after I got there. But not only did I stay the entire time we planned, we We were granted another press card to cover the election afterwards. But this one was unique from a journalist perspective in that we couldn't plan for anything. There was no way to do security analysis to know where to go and if a place would be reasonably safe or completely dangerous. I mean, at some points, we were at a checkpoint and the soldiers stopped us and they asked us to stay out of the car and we waited for a while. And they told us later, the reason why we were being stopped both in and out of that area was because they never saw foreigner journalists coming this way. They didn't know what the rule was, whether they were supposed to let us pass or not. There was at some point we were in the middle of nowhere and somebody said, there's a sniper on the mountain pointing at you. And so we left quickly. But honestly, I have no idea if there was a sniper in the mountain. I didn't see it. And I'm not sure that person was telling the truth. So yeah, there was a lot of not knowing what's happening, what's going on, and what could happen in any moment. There was a 16-year-old girl that we met in the hospital who had been shot in the face. And she had been playing in the yard with her friends when her area was attacked. She wasn't, I don't think she was targeted, or at least she didn't think so. But she was old enough to grasp what this was going to mean for the rest of her life, as well as young enough to be traumatized and terrified by being attacked in a war that she has no part in making, or not even much understanding of what it's about. I didn't realize that this conflict is not a new conflict. It is an extension of a conflict that has been going on for so, so many years. The longer it goes on, the worse it's going to get. I'm not sure what the solution is, but continuing the fighting it's growing exponentially at the moment, as far as I can tell. So I think that was the thing that I didn't know and that worries me the most, because from being there, from writing about it, from talking to people, and from making this documentary and all the news stories we did, it feels just overwhelmingly sad and utterly hopeless, and I'm not sure what should be done or what can be done, but something has to be done.
And that was VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking to me from Istanbul, Turkey. And after the break, we will bring you the VOA documentary, Terror in Tigray. We'll be right back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Welcome back. This week, we're taking you inside Ethiopia's Tigray region and the growing humanitarian disaster there. Earlier this year, VOA's Heather Murdoch and her team travelled inside the largely cut-off conflict zone as well as refugee camps in neighbouring Sudan to bring you the stories of the many people displaced by the conflict. Here is Terror in Tigray.
What would it take for you to walk out of the door of your house with nothing, run through violence on the streets, and then walk to another country with no food, property, or money? To a place that is already desperately poor, where you don't speak the language? What terror would have to happen for you to do all this, leaving your 3-year-old daughter behind?
Horrifying accounts of human rights abuses continue to emerge from Ethiopia's northern Tigray region.
Reports of atrocities and food shortages.
The UN says without significant help, things could deteriorate.
Ka
the Salmati road, Nancy Gamus was a Demica Fila, Nancy's Hazard. Jagalu.
My name is Haftan Kidu. When I was in my country, I was living my life in good way. Just when the war has happened, I came here as refugee people. I don't have a full information about my family. They are in life or they are died. So in case of this one, yeah, I came here alone.
In late 2020, war broke out in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Tens of thousands of people, like Haftan, fled to camps in Sudan, where they remain, with no prospect of going home. More than 1 million people are displaced inside Ethiopia, and propaganda from both sides makes it hard for outsiders to know what's going on. Phone and internet service has also mostly been cut in Tigray, and roads are often closed. When we travel through Tigray in mid-2021, families tell us they collected the bodies of civilians from the streets and buried them in mass graves. They say their homes and businesses have been looted. Hospitals are full of war injured, including children as young as 4. Gabre is a farmer who owns a little bit of land and 2 cows in a town that has been fought over for months. After what he says was a massacre of civilians, it took him 3 weeks to get his daughter to this hospital.
Here she was shot with a gun, and the bullet came out through her hand.
Almost all the healthcare centers in Tigray have been damaged, destroyed, or looted. Every parent we speak to here says the same thing. Their children barely survived. But they did survive. So many other children did not. Families that managed to flee across the border in early 2021 are scattered, and most refugees we meet in the camps have missing loved ones.
The hardest are the people which is have not like family, like their fathers, like their mothers, like their sisters, their brothers. They leave some guys alone, you know? They eat, but they think about their family. Maybe some of them they die. When they think about them, they become sad.
This boy does not know where his family is.
My name is Nahom. I came from Hamara in Ethiopia. I'm 13 years old. My mom and dad went to get my brother, and they locked me in the house. But when the bomb exploded next to my home, I ran out through the backyard. I thought it was going to hit me in the head. I saw a corpse being eaten by large birds.
Michaela Haftu was an artist in Tigray before he escaped with his pregnant wife and small daughter.
The bombs kept going on for 4 days. We hope it would stop in a day or two. But they didn't fire their weapons at night. So we left at night. We walked through the forest. My wife was already pregnant. There were snakes, hyenas, and scorpions. But my wife said she was tired and sick, so we had to stop to sleep. We saw horrifying things. Body parts were scattered. What is in Himara?
Have you listened?
In the rush to escape the war, other parents we meet lost their children.
My name is Zafu Haftu. I came from Ba'athar in Tigray, but I worked and studied in Humara. I worked in a store. I managed the area where they kept the products. And I was about to finish my studies with a degree in accounting and finance.
When Zafu was awarded a scholarship, her husband was angry that she would pursue her education and abandoned her. So Zafu left her daughter in Bakr with her mother while she studied and worked to support them.
I was separated from my daughter because of school. But when we were together, she was so happy. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for her. When the war started, I tried to go to Ba'athar to get my daughter. But heavy weapons were being fired, and it was so bad. The soldiers said no one is allowed to go there. And they would not let me pass. I couldn't stay in Humara because there was heavy shelling. So I fled with my landlords to Hamdait. I had no money, so I relied on them for food for 3 days. I came with only the clothes I was wearing. I didn't bring my school or work documents. No one else from my family came here. It was so hard. I was exhausted and couldn't search anymore. I couldn't eat for 5 or 6 days. Her name is Magda Gebretzadeq.
Every person has his own ambition. You know? He needs to be successful. He needs to lead his life in the best way. But when he gets setback like this war, when he maybe lose his lovers, his girlfriend, his family, his friends, his mother, his fathers, it become hopeless. Just he does not care about his life. Even when he going to be die, he don't care.
Even Zarat's child is like a baby under 1 year old. They do not get enough water, even enough food. They may be sick, you know. No one can give for some treatment in hospitals. When I look like this one, I feel sad, you know. Just I don't have capacity, but if I have, I need to help them.
Christian Ethiopian refugees in Sudan celebrate the holy day of Epiphany. Ethiopia is religiously diverse, but the country's divisions are seldom blamed on religious differences. This war, and so many other conflicts in Ethiopia, is between ethnic groups, or perhaps more accurately, as locals often explain, between powerful men who use ethnic divisions to stoke conflict and gain power. Johannes Negusa is a priest who fled Tigray as bombs exploded near his home in Humara.
When a person is weak, he argues with his children and wife. The Lord said, I am peace, and you should live in peace. Because I am peace, you should live peacefully and with love. These are his words. He doesn't allow fighting. Instead, we create weakness and chaos.
Yeah.
but in Aksum, the city believed to be the birthplace of Christianity in Ethiopia. Locals tell us it is terror, not weakness, causing the chaos. Hundreds of people were killed in Aksum as Ethiopian and Eritrean forces swept through the region. Locals told us varying details about what happened, ranging from mass shootings to house-to-house raids. Consistent in every person's story, however, were descriptions of so many bodies.
They were searching homes door to door in some areas, but most people escaped to the countryside, afraid of what had happened. Nobody could bury the dead bodies.
Amnesty International later described what happened in Aksum as possible crimes against humanity. Tigray has endured many other war crimes, the organization also says. Thousands of civilians have been killed, and the economy is decimated. By mid-2021, famine was already underway, with fears emerging that hunger could be used as a weapon of war. And this is not the first time. In the 1980s, the world watched as war and famine ravaged Ethiopia. More than 300,000 Ethiopian refugees fled to Sudan then, most of them from Tigray. In the camps, many of the refugees are returning for the second time. As hard as it was then, they tell us, it is, in some ways, even harder now.
This time it is worse. This time it is too much. People are being burned alive, and homes and churches are being destroyed. My name is Berhane Masala, and I am 74. Listen, let me tell you, almost everyone was killed. People die in front of you. When you flee, you see people's bodies scattered as they were killed, falling and shaking. Now, what can I say? You know how it is. We are happy to get these shelters here.
Decades of war ended in 1991 with the toppling of a repressive military government. A Tigrayan military fighter, Meles Zenawi, emerged to lead a new government of ethnic federalism, which divided the country along ethnic lines. The Ethiopian economy grew fast, but political repression continued. Territorial disputes with neighbors, including the newly independent Eritrea, once part of Ethiopia, turned into armed conflict. Resentment grew of Tigrayans, who make up 6% of the population, but the Tigrayan elite dominated the country politically. After Meles' death in 2012, a period of unrest continued until 2018, when a young ethnic Oromo, Abiy Ahmed, rose to power. He made peace with Eritrea and instituted democratic reforms, earning him a Nobel Peace Prize the following year. But when Tigray held local elections in defiance of the central government, a simmering rift quickly escalated. In November 2020, the government accused Tigrayan forces of attacking a military base and launched an offensive. The central government, backed by Eritrean forces and Amhara militias, is fighting Tigrayan regional forces and militias. Both sides have claimed the other started the war.
Amhara people, they told for the Tigray, we are supporter of you. We are supporter of you, they told. And Tigray people, they told for the Amhara people, we are supporter of you. So when we come to this one, how they can make peace between them?
The hostility is real, but it is fueled by cyclical violence and leaders encouraging animosity for their own gain, not ancient hatreds. Tigrayan and Amhara people have lived together in peace and intermarried for as long as anyone can remember.
My wife is Amhara, and I am Tigrayan. If she comes to my village, she can live. No one will touch her. But if I have to go to Amhara, they will kill me for sure.
When people get to the camps in Sudan, it is often not clear how to get shelters, food, and water, or if it's available at all. Haftum rarely has extra money from the small jobs he picks up around the camps, so he tries to help people by sharing information.
I need to help. Just when I help the people, my brain, it gets peace, you know? My brain, it becomes in a good condition, you know? Even I believe. When you good things, that good things, it come back to you. If cannot be come back to me, they can be come back to my child. They can be come back to my family, even to all my countries. So helping for the people is the first interest of me.
It's a principle he's held since before the war, when he worked to improve business and agricultural practices for farmers like his parents. But finding help is especially difficult for those who are already disabled or sick, like Michaela and his wife, who are HIV positive.
At first, we didn't get the HIV medications for 3 days, but since I reported my health status here, I have had them. Where is food? It doesn't come. We buy food when someone gives us money, like you did the other day. We cannot eat the food they give us, but we are surviving. With HIV, it is hard to eat just anything.
Local Sudanese people have helped more than the organizations. People here are not happy. There are 5 people in a room, and there are fights.
Here, I don't have a blanket or a mat to sleep on. Do you know where I slept yesterday? Over there is a military school and a playground. I slept there with no blanket and no mat.
Is there an organization you can go to that takes care of children who are alone without their parents?
He said it's full.
Even if he could get in, Nahom says he doesn't want to stay with an organization. He says the children are not free to roam the camp, and he's heard they don't get enough food. Haftum takes another boy, 16, who is alone in the camp, to the organization. And he too is told they have as many children as they can support.
So he has no family. They say it for us. We cannot do anything now.
Even Haftum, who positions himself as someone to help the most vulnerable, sees no future for himself here in the camp, in Sudan, or in returning to Tigray.
I lose my home, even my document. Just I have already graduated. Just when I go back to my home, really I cannot get my document. Really, they already burn out. They can throw it on the road. Just that's give me like hopeless, like this disappointed.
After the last war, we went home when they told us there was peace. We went back to our homes with a little help from the Red Cross. When we returned to Ethiopia, my mother's siblings were killed. My story is like this. I am repeating her story. If I find my family, I'll bring them here. I will not live there.
World leaders have accused all parties, the Ethiopian military, the Eritrean military, and militias associated with the Tigray and Amhara parties of human rights abuses. But government forces and their allies have been accused of mass murders, forced removals, and ethnically motivated violence, including systematic mass rape. Hundreds of women and girls from across Tigray have reported being raped by soldiers. And aid workers say there are likely many, many more who have kept silent out of fear, shame, or just lack of access to any kind of health care. The stories they tell us are eerily similar. Soldiers came to their houses, demanding to know where a husband, father, or brother was, insisting he was a rebel fighter. When the man did not appear, a wife, daughter, or sister was attacked.
They pointed a gun at me and shouted, "We know your father is a fighter. Give us his guns."
I told them, "I don't know where my husband is. I haven't heard from him since he left."
Then they raped me, and the baby was crying the whole time.
The Ethiopian government has arrested dozens of soldiers accused of rape, but has mostly been silent on the issue. The government has also acknowledged many other abuses, but blames Tigrayan forces, who it designated a terrorist organization. For many refugees, returning to Tigray is not an option. Some fear the conflict could even spread to the camps.
Even now, we are very scared to be here because we can see on TV that militia says, even if they are in a camp in Sudan, we can bring them here by force. Our lives are in danger. If the world can see and hear us, we need a solution.
Rights organizations and other leaders have called upon the Ethiopian government to hold peace talks. But the conflict continues as alarming reports of extreme hunger and famine emerge amid fears the humanitarian crisis will continue to deepen.
We were forced out of our country, and now the world is watching us die again. I suppose the world is blind.
Be sure to join me on the next Straight Talk Africa as we discuss the return of Africa's stolen art. France has repatriated 26 looted colonial-era artifacts to Benin. Now museums in Europe and the US are rethinking what to do with their African art collections. We'll speak to artists and museum curators about the colonial past of Africa's art and its future around the world. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is our show this week. Thank you to all my guests and all my colleagues who contributed to this week's show. And thank you for always watching and always listening. I'll see you next time. Take care. Goodbye.